Blog Talk Radio. Thank you for listening to the PCOS Challenge Radio Show. Tune in regularly to get insights from leading experts and the support you need. Also, be sure to join our social network at PCOSChallenge.com and sign up for our newsletter. This is Sasha Ati. Help spread the word and take the PCOS Challenge.
Today's radio show focuses on getting answers for lean women with PCOS. This is Sasha Ati, your host of the PCOS Challenge radio show and also PCOSChallenge.com, the support and networking site for women with polycystic ovarian syndrome. Our guest today is Dr. Daniel Domesic. Dr. Domesic is a clinical scientist who treats women with infertility from various reproductive and metabolic disorders. Dr. Domesic is professor and division chief of reproductive endocrinology and infertility in the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology at the University of California, Los Angeles. He leads an NIH-sponsored clinical trial on polycystic ovary syndrome and has served as principal investigator for several projects by providing extensive expertise in designing human clinical studies and procedures, diagnosing metabolic dysfunction, performing transvaginal ovarian ultrasonography, analyzing data, and assessing clinical outcome measurements. Dr. Domesic has also supervised the acquisition and analysis of research data compiled from these studies. Dr. Domesic, welcome to the PCOS Challenge radio show.
Oh, thank you, Sasha, so much. It's a delight to be here.
There's a population of women with PCOS who are lean, and they're searching for answers and feel kind of left out in the conversation around PCOS. Before we speak specifically about the lean phenotype, let's tell us about polycystic ovary syndrome. What is it? How is it diagnosed?
Well, polycystic ovary syndrome in its classic form is really the combination of two characteristics. Number one is irregular periods that are due to the fact that a woman does not ovulate regularly. And the second component is an elevation of male hormone productions, generally from the ovary, which cause the patient or most patients to have some evidence of androgen excess in the skin, either abnormal hair growth in a male distribution, which is known as hirsutism, or acne. And the combination of some element of overproduction of the male hormone testosterone in combination with menstrual irregularity has been kind of the hallmark of classic polycystic ovary syndrome, because the high production of male hormone coming from the ovary interferes with the normal signals that make a woman develop a follicle in the ovary and to ovulate. So that if one were to do an ultrasound and study the ovaries of a woman who have those two features, most of those women also have slightly enlarged ovaries with multiple accumulation of small follicles, each of which has an egg in it. And traditionally, that was known as the polycystic ovary as opposed to polycystic ovary syndrome. The word cystic is really a misnomer, because when an ultrasound looks at the ovaries and sees these accumulations of follicles in the ovaries, they were initially described as cysts, but they're essentially an accumulation or what we call a stockpiling of follicles that accumulate when a woman does not ovulate. So the combination of those three things, some evidence of overproduction of the male hormone, in the presence of irregular menstrual cycles because of anovulation, and the combination of polycystic ovaries by imaging, is the classic form of polycystic ovary syndrome. Over the years, there's been an expansion of the definition of polycystic ovary syndrome to more milder phenotypes or characteristics that we can talk about later as you wish, But most people, when they talk about classic polycystic ovary syndrome, talk about menstrual irregularity and abnormal production of the male hormone testosterone.
So as you said, the name cyst when describing polycystic ovary syndrome is a misnomer. A lot of people get confused about the word polycystic and confuse it with other ovarian cysts. Can you describe the difference between ovarian cysts, other ovarian cysts, and the ones described in polycystic ovary?
So to look at it from the perspective of a normal follicle, if one were to study the growth of a normal follicle in a woman who ovulates, the follicle starts at about a diameter of 2 millimeters. It grows with the egg in it until it reaches about the size of a 20-millimeter follicle, or slightly less than an inch, and then the egg is released. So under normal circumstances, the follicle goes from about 2 millimeters to about 20 or 24 millimeters in its normal growth. In women with polycystic ovary syndrome, the follicles arrest because they do not grow beyond a certain point. So most of the follicles that you see in a polycystic ovary are about 9 millimeters or less. That's different than a woman who develops a cyst on her ovary, which can occur for a whole host of reasons, because women can have benign cysts on the ovaries, they can have malignant cysts on the ovaries for a whole host of different reasons. Most of those cysts are anywhere from about 30 or 40 millimeters or 3 to 4 centimeters up to even larger dimensions. So when a physician hears that a woman has a cyst, for example, that ruptured or something that another doctor saw and was referring them in, they think of relatively large cysts that are well over 30 to 40 millimeters in size. When you look at a polycystic ovary, all of those follicles are somewhere between 2 and 9 millimeters, so they're small, and they are not cysts. They're actually arrested follicles that stop growing on their trajectory to a normal growth of a follicle.
Well, thank you very much for that clarification. So the topic of this show is getting answers for lean women with PCOS. And obesity is not listed as a part of the diagnostic criteria for PCOS, yet many women are overweight. However, there are also many who are lean women with PCOS and are sometimes not considered by their physicians for a diagnosis of PCOS. What are the challenges around diagnosing PCOS, and what are the special diagnostic challenges for the lean phenotype?
Well, that's an excellent question, Sasha. And to put it in perspective, the way we try and explain it to our patients and our colleagues is that there's a polycystic ovary phenotype that I'll describe in a moment that's characterized by a woman who is lean. She is not overweight. And that type of phenotype makes her susceptible to any of the adverse effects that obesity brings to her as a separate risk factor. A good example of that is when we look at insulin resistance. And insulin resistance in normal women is a condition that as they gain weight, their body becomes resistant to insulin action, and so they mount more insulin production from the pancreas. And that situation is associated with a number of risk factors for metabolic disease. If you look at a woman who has lean PCOS, she has a very, very subtle reduction in her insulin sensitivity, a little bit, which means she has a slight impairment of her insulin action. And in the presence of obesity or being overweight, which also introduces insulin resistance, she has an additive effect of both of those issues, her PCOS and her obesity, which makes her insulin resistance out of proportion to that of being obese. So we have to focus on lean PCOS women, recognizing that it can be a type of risk factor so that people look healthy, They appear healthy to the physician because they equate a lot of metabolic problems with the mere fact of being obese, and yet these people have this susceptibility, if you will, that if they keep it in check and if they maintain their body mass correctly, they might be fine throughout their whole life, but they still are at some increased risk for the aspects of metabolic problems later in life, much like an individual can have a family history where they're at risk for hypertension or they're at risk for diabetes. And there's a lot of families that have risk factors for diseases that if they're kept in check, they do well. They just have to be aware that they have some risk being in a lean position to begin with.
Usually for women who are overweight with PCOS, a lot of physicians suggest weight loss, 10% body fat reduction to increase fertility or improve fertility. What are the options for lean women with PCOS who can't lose any more weight?
Well, a couple of things. If I could, I'd like to share with you some of the research we're doing that's giving us a sense of where we are, where we need to go with people who have lean PCOS. If you look at it from the spectrum of all women, as they gain weight, tend to develop fat around their abdomen to some degree. And we know that the fat around the abdomen, that's characteristic of men, but women can develop that too as they gain weight. That's an independent risk factor for insulin resistance, independent of their weight. So that's a body fat distribution is an important risk factor for disease in both men and women. It's just men tend to put on more abdominal fat than women, but women can do that too. When you look at women, all women, who are lean, and this is whether they have PCOS or not, and if you ask a very simple question, I'm going to look at insulin sensitivity and what controls that, even in a lean individual, a lean woman, it's still the amount of abdominal fat they have. You may not see it when somebody's standing up, but when we do our sophisticated imaging with our radiographic machines, we are finding that both normal women and lean women with PCOS who have normal insulin sensitivity, if you study very carefully what controls insulin sensitivity in their body, it's still the amount of fat around their abdomen. Now, they're still within a normal range, so they're healthy because they have normal insulin sensitivity. But if they were to gain weight, if they were to change some of their energy utilization, then the PCOS woman, as compared to a normal woman, as she gains weight and as she ages, she tends to have a propensity to develop the fat and deposit it on her abdomen. So the real issue with the lean PCOS women is, first of all, maybe you're entirely healthy and have normal insulin sensitivity. Let's find out what the circumstances are. One of the papers that was published not too long ago by our colleague Ricardo Aziz had mentioned, and rightfully so, that when we study insulin resistance in PCOS women, it's quoted that the majority of these PCOS women have insulin resistance. But the studies are generally done in clinical settings in the hospital where patients are referred in. They're already seeing doctors for problems, and they are not necessarily women from the general population who have PCOS, out on the street, living their lives, working, and feeling fine. In our study, when we studied people who had lean polycystic ovary syndrome and reached out to the general population, the students on the UCLA campus, we found that many of them have totally normal insulin sensitivity. They don't have any metabolic problems whatsoever. So when you start talking about lean PCOS, the first question is, do you really have any problems with insulin resistance yet? You might be fine. And the trick will be to maintain your body status as you age and not lapse into the general weight accumulation that occurs in the whole population as we age with time. So when we look at, well, how do you treat a woman with PCOS metabolically speaking? Maybe the trick is to keep that person with her energy utilization entirely balanced, knowing that she's healthy as she's lean. Or if she is insulin resistant and lean, we know that body loss, weight loss will not help because she's already lean. So then the next issue is, well, how do you enhance the ability of the body to increase their insulin sensitivity? That can be done by increasing muscle mass. The reason for that is because muscle burns up energy and increases insulin sensitivity independent of weight loss. So if a lean woman is insulin sensitive, she's already fine metabolically, you don't really need to do much other than have her maintain her status. If she's lean and does have insulin resistance, the next component would be to see what is her exercise all about, because by increasing muscle mass, you can actually increase insulin sensitivity. If that doesn't work, or if somebody's already done that and they're still insulin resistant, then that's the role of metformin as the first line therapy. And if an individual is lean, and if they have appropriate, what we call lifestyle modification, appropriate energy intake and exercise physiology in terms of their amount of exercise per week, which is generally recommended at about 30 minutes a day for anywhere from 5 to 7 days per week, then in the presence of continued insulin resistance, that's where we introduce some of our medications like metformin.
I think that was a very great observation about the women in the general population versus women who are being studied. So the issue here is...
Well, I think the important message is that if you have polycystic ovary syndrome and if you're lean, then by looking carefully at your metabolic status and at your reproductive status, a tailor-made management can be outlined that addresses exactly the degree of abnormality in each one of those areas, metabolism versus reproduction. And some women may have a totally normal metabolic profile, and yet they have reproductive problems because the testosterone or the androgens are driving other elements in their reproductive status, or vice versa. So it's not a one-size-fits-all. It's, I think, right, careful surveillance of each one of those two pathways, metabolism and reproduction, and seeing where that individual is. We're finding that a large number of our women with PCOS by classic criteria that I just mentioned, when they're studied as young, lean individuals living their lives as students and young adults, many of them have normal insulin action. Because they're young and they're healthy. And I think that's a message which I think is on one hand encouraging, but on the other hand, I don't mean it to sound as if that shouldn't be assessed in each individual to make sure that individual fits the appropriate criteria.
I have to interject some listener questions shortly. However, a lot of lean women with PCOS complain about gaining a massive amount of weight almost overnight. What triggers this in women with PCOS?
Well, this has been studied for several years, and one of our colleagues, Leo Wiggum and Dr. David Abbott at the University of Wisconsin, published a paper a couple of years ago looking at this, because we hear this in the clinic all the time, where people with PCOS come in and say, you know, they're having a hard time losing weight. And I think the first response from the doctor is one of disbelief. Are you really sure that's true? And so, you know, people start questioning, well, maybe you need a nutrition and maybe you need more exercise. And although that might be true, it's fairly glib. And yet when you look at some of these people who have that complaint, they are doing everything exactly right. You know, they're trying to maintain a caloric diet that's within their energy utilization. They're exercising exactly as I described, and yet they still have this propensity to weight gain if they let their guard down, or sometimes even if they don't. So a couple of years ago, Dr. Abbott and Dr. Wiggum studied lean PCOS women in what are called BOD pods. And BOD pods are these units where somebody can stay in this contained unit where they can figure out the metabolism within this chamber. And normally what happens is when people sleep, when women sleep throughout the night, they burn off the sugar from their liver as a source of energy because they're obviously fasting while they're sleeping. And then in the early morning hours, what happens is that when the sugar is burned up sufficiently, then the fat gets metabolized as the next energy source of fuel. Their studies showed that although the evening metabolism of lean PCOS was normal, as they slept and there should have been a trigger or a change more to fat metabolism, that did not occur. So when the sugar burned off, the next fuel source was protein, an amino acid, and not fat. So essentially they were fat sparers, if you will. Now, that paper, which is already out in the community, in the scientific community, raises to me the interesting question as to whether women with polycystic ovary syndrome who complain about the inability to lose weight really might be a manifestation of that similar phenomenon, mm-hmm. where that their body is hardwired, if you will, through mechanisms that we call programming, to hold on to fat. And therefore, that individual will be susceptible to weight gain as opposed to another person who otherwise would normally burn up their fat in a normal process. And this brings up kind of the background in the genetics of polycystic ovary syndrome and why some people would do that as a good thing in nature as opposed to what we view as a problem.
That certainly does answer some questions and raise even more for me. So let's get to some listener questions. First, it's Amy. She said she cannot tolerate metformin. She's not trying to get pregnant, and she is a skinny woman with PCOS. She's trying to get rid of her acne and hair in unwanted places. Any recommendations?
Okay. So the first question I would ask in a situation like this, because we have people referred in with similar concerns, the question is whether metformin is the appropriate agent to be using. Women with polycystic ovary syndrome present to their doctors with several complaints, and it's important to prioritize what's the most important issue in that patient. Metformin is indicated for glucose intolerance, which is a form of insulin resistance where the woman cannot, or a man for that matter, but the individual cannot burn up the sugar in an appropriate way. That's the purpose of a glucose tolerance test, where if one gives an individual a certain amount of glucose, it should be metabolized at a certain rate over a couple of hours, and you can measure that. That's called glucose intolerance, and that's prediabetes. That is the indication for metformin for women with PCOS. Metformin does not work well for hirsutism. Metformin does not work well for acne. And the reason for that is because metformin acts to lower insulin and only modestly reduces testosterone, and in some cases it doesn't. So that the use of metformin has to be targeted to the primary symptom of what the patient presents. If this individual is complaining of acne and hirsutism, and if she has a normal glucose tolerance test, she should not be on metformin. It's not going to work. And so under those circumstances, assuming that, let's say, the metformin is not the primary drug of choice for her symptoms, the traditional management for both acne and for hirsutism is a type of low-dose oral contraceptive, which lowers the androgens by suppressing the ovary, with or without the introduction of an anti-androgen. And the most common antiandrogen in the United States is spironolactone, which is commonly used in combination with the oral contraceptives. The purpose of those drugs is to lower the androgen levels, but an individual will still need some sort of local therapy on the skin for either the hirsutism with its removal, with either electrolysis or laser, generally speaking, or an astringent of the skin to try and enhance the drying of the skin and the reduction of the sebum from the sweat glands itself.
Okay. The next question we have is, hello, doctor. I am a thin 32-year-old married woman with PCOS. My biggest trouble is infertility. I have irregular cycles and never know when I'm ovulating. I go months without a period sometimes. My husband and I have been trying for a baby for over 2 years. Can you please give me some advice?
Okay. So the complaint here or the concern here is a reproductive one. And so the first thought is, well, what's the role of elevated testosterone levels in women and the interference with ovulation? As I mentioned before, what happens with women with polycystic ovary syndrome, the androgens are produced from the ovary in great concentrations because that's their site of origin, and they only secondarily dilute out in the blood because women have maybe 3 liters of blood to dilute the androgen level. So when we see it in the blood test, it's actually higher in the ovary than we measure in the blood. The high levels of the androgen in the ovary inhibit the follicle from growing beyond that 9-millimeter stage. So there's a couple ways that that can be treated. The common use of oral medicine called Clomid is intended to block hormone feedback on the hypothalamus, which is in the brain and the pituitary gland in the head, and that increases FSH, the hormone follicle-stimulating hormone that normally makes the follicle grow. This has been around for many, many years. It is successful in lean individuals with PCOS in inducing ovulation in about 80% of the time. There are a couple of different doses that can be used to accomplish that. The downside to the Clomid is that there's a multiple birth rate that's associated with it, depending on how many follicles develop, and that can be anywhere from 5 to 10%. There are other oral medicines that are available. Another one is letrozole, which blocks hormone-negative feedback in a slightly different way but elevates FSH. Metformin also can induce ovulation in women. It tends to work slower but can be used. And if those first-line agents don't work, there's actually second-line agents where we can give FSH. It's manufactured. You can give it. And in countries that tend not to have some of these medications, there's a procedure called an ovarian drilling. We don't do that necessarily as much as, I suppose, other parts of the country, but that brings up the idea of some individuals who can put a telescope into the abdomen, and they can actually either with a laser beam or a thermal needle, they can place that into the center of the ovary where the testosterone comes from. They can destroy that part with current or laser, and that actually induces ovulation as well. In the United States, that's considered second line therapy. The oral medicines and some of these other injectable forms of FSH are highly successful in fertility. So I would encourage a person like this to seek the service of an infertility specialist in her area. Ovulation induction for women with polycystic ovary syndrome is highly successful.
So we're running out of time, but I want to get to one more question. And this is, I have had 2 miscarriages and do not want to ever experience that again. I have PCOS and hypothyroidism. What can I do to get pregnant, stay pregnant until I deliver a healthy child?
Okay, if this woman is not overweight and is lean, then the concerns of miscarriage go beyond polycystic ovary syndrome because as far as we can tell, the miscarriage data in women with PCOS is directly related to the obesity component of the patient. And so that needs to be looked at separately. If an individual is obese or overweight, we know that's associated with miscarriage in and of itself. But for the sake of argument, if this woman has lean PCOS, the issues for miscarriage are the following. Hypothyroidism is associated with...
Yeah, she said she had hypothyroidism as well.
Yes. So hypothyroidism can be associated with miscarriage. And individuals who have a history of miscarriage are tested for hypothyroidism with a TSH level. That should be within the normal range for sure. Beyond that, another hormone called prolactin is associated with miscarriage, which also can be measured in the blood. The shape of the uterine cavity needs to be assessed. That can be easily done with an ultrasound or some other test to look at the configuration of the uterine cavity. Sometimes the genetics of the mother and the father contribute to miscarriage through what we call balanced translocations of their genes, which essentially means that their genes are normal in number but misarranged on the chromosomes, which can be transmitted to the offspring. Those are genetic tests that can be easily measured. And finally, in some individuals, there's a syndrome called antiphospholipid syndrome, where individuals can develop antibodies against the normal phospholipids or the lipid layer of cells, including the cells of an embryo. And those are also tests that can be measured as part of a miscarriage. So what I would say in a person like this who's had some miscarriages and who wants to minimize the risk of that happening again, a simple workup of those tests will certainly be able to identify those individuals who are at recurrent risk for miscarriage. And if necessary, additional things can be done in the future that can be done to prevent it even more so.
All right. I really wish that we had time to speak to you more. I'm enjoying this talk, Dr. Domestic, and hopefully we'll have a chance to speak again on this topic and others related to PCOS.
Oh, I would be delighted, Sasha, anytime. And thank you for the invitation. It's wonderful talking to you.
Before you go, just tell us about your study that you're currently doing, the NIH-sponsored clinical trial, and how women with PCOS can become involved.
Well, that's wonderful. Thank you for asking. We are looking at women with polycystic ovary syndrome who are lean, who have the classical criteria that I've discussed, who are between the ages of 19 and 35, who have a body mass index less than 25 kilograms per meter squared. And we're also reaching out to individuals who are Caucasian, non-Hispanic individuals to control for ethnic backgrounds, which is also another variable we didn't have a chance to talk about today. Because the common element of polycystic ovary syndrome is an elevation of androgen, we are looking at its effects on three aspects of the body. Reproduction, as we talked about in this one case just now, this one woman. We're looking at sugar metabolism, and we're looking at fat metabolism as risk factors for heart disease. And our study is recruiting these patients and trying a different type of anti-androgen over 6 months to see if we can reverse any abnormalities of their fat metabolism, their sugar metabolism, and their reproduction over a six-month trial of a different type of anti-androgen that's intended to block androgen action and allow normalization of their reproduction and their metabolic status. And we're currently beginning our third year in March, and if individuals are interested in our participating, they can certainly call us or go to our website, and we can give them much more information.
As I mentioned before, thank you so much for joining the PCOS Challenge Radio Show. It was a very enlightening talk today, and I enjoyed it tremendously. Thank you so much for sharing your knowledge on this topic that's not often talked about.
Oh, my pleasure, Sasha, and all the best, and I'm happy to talk with you anytime you wish.
Thank you, and enjoy the rest of your day.
Okay. Thank you, Sasha. Bye now.
Thank you for listening to the PCOS Challenge Radio Show. Tune in regularly to get insights from leading experts and the support you need. Also, be sure to join our social network at PCOSChallenge.com and sign up for our newsletter. This is Sasha Ati. Help spread the word and take the PCOS Challenge.